To be turning your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs chapter 4. We'll get started there in just a moment. Proverbs chapter 4. And someone please read verse 23. Okay, someone, chapter 23 and verse 7. 23 and verse 7. Alright, as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Now turn to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. And let's look together at verses 18 through 20. Matthew 15, verses 18 through 20. Okay. What is the main, from those three passages, what's the main gist of those three? The heart. Okay. And as we're talking about the heart, are we talking about what pumps the blood, or what are we talking about? Talking about the mind, aren't we? Talking about basically, as Jesus puts, as the Proverbs writer puts, Solomon puts there, what makes the man. It's as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Jesus says that comes from the heart is what defiles the man, not eating with unwashed hands. It's what comes forth out of the mouth, because what comes forth out of the mouth shows what character the man has, isn't it? And so that's what we're getting at here. Now, the entire purpose of reading those three passages together, as we talk about the devil, sin, and hell, and we've been concentrating the last few weeks on sin, okay, is the attitude a person has toward sin. There are five basic improper attitudes that we have, that man can have towards sin. What do you suppose some of those are? What can man do? What can an attitude be towards sin that would be wrong? Okay. Just a little sin. Someone may think of a lie as a little white lie, right? All right. What else? What's another way we can look at sin that would be improper? What's an improper attitude towards sin? Larry, do you have something? Okay, to woe unto him that calls evil good and good evil, right? Okay. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm not hurting anyone else. Okay, good. You suppose maybe those thoughts could have crossed Adam's and Eve's minds? I'm not hurting anybody else. There's nobody else to hurt, right? What else? Anybody? Everybody's doing it. Okay. Anyone else? Alright, discounting it. Don't worry about it. Alright, let's look at some of these specifically. One of the improper attitudes that we can have towards sin is dismissing it or just denying it. Denying that it even exists. And believe it or not, there are some groups out there that would deny that sin even exists. They believe that, they will even teach that sin is just not a reality. There are unbelievers of every stripe, even some modernists today. We see evidence of them denying the reality of sin by the way they speak of it. Folks will speak of sin as well, and they dismiss it, as Mr. Lewis pointed out, by just saying, well, sin is just something that's thought up by man. It's just some mental agitation. Someone else says, well, it's just a theological abstraction or an invention of the clergy to keep the clergy in business or to prevent people from having a good time. And so this is just some way that folks just deny sin. Did you know that there are even some religions, some folks that are religious, at least they claim to be, that deny that sin exists? You ever heard of the Christian Scientists? They deny that sin exists. Listen to what their own book says here. The notion that both evil and good are real is a delusion of material sense which science annihilates. Evil is nothing, no thing, mind, nor power. And according to that philosophy, you're looking at, basically, there's no good, there's no evil. It's just some figment of the imagination, as some folks look at it. And so one improper attitude towards sin is just simply to deny deny sin, number one, and then some would deny that it even exists. What does the Bible say? And as we've been looking over the past few weeks, what does the Bible have to say about sin? Okay, the law teaches us sin, right? Paul gives that, gives us that insight. What does he says about the law of Moses, as Miss Lois has pointed out, what does he say the law taught him about sin? Everything, right? If it had not been for the law of Moses, what would the Israelites have known about sin? Nothing, really. How did the law of Moses teach us and teach the Israelites about sin? Okay, not the sin. Okay. What did sin require of the Israelites? Sacrifice. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, didn't we? How much blood was shed, not just on a daily but an annual basis, by the Israelites because of sin? It's unimaginable, isn't it? I mean, you think of all the lambs, the goats, the bullocks, the turtle doves, if you were poor. All these animals that were killed and the blood that was shed because of what? Sin. Why do you suppose God set it up like that? Ma'am? Alright, so that they would try harder not to sin and to give them a picture. This is what sin costs, right? Yes, ma'am. We can infer that because they were given these coats of skin. And so the first sacrifice most likely that was made was there in Genesis chapter 3 to make atonement there for their sin. Okay. And so it has always been, a picture. The shedding of blood has always been a picture of sin. All right. He wanted people that could worship him and not the world. But the Bible tells us that sin is real. Okay, the Bible, and it shows us this with all these and the definitions of sin. What is 1 John 3? How does John define sin? Sin is the what of the law? Transgression. All right, we've talked about that word. What does it mean? Transgression. Disobedience. Literally, it means to what? Go beyond. Literally, it means to go beyond. Okay, so in other words, God has drawn a line in the sand. To transgress means to do what to that line? Step over it. Okay? Alright, sin, the word translated as sin literally means what? To miss the mark. Okay, the idea, is basically of an archer, right? He's got a target. If he misses that target, it is said of him that he has missed the mark. He's transgressed. He's sinned. All right? Romans 3 and verse 23 says what of sin? Sin is to go beyond, but sin is also what? For all have sinned and done what? Fallen short. Okay? So you can go beyond and sin, but you can also fall short and sin. Okay, so God has certain requirements of us in the Bible. So the Bible affirms that sin is real. The Bible affirms that sin is a universal malady, and the Bible convicts us of sin as such. What does the cross say about sin? All right, Jesus dying on the cross and the blood that was shed there forgives us of our sin? What does it tell us about the reality of sin? Alright. Just as the old law, the sin caused death of all these animals, with Jesus the Christ, sin caused His death, didn't it? Isn't that why Jesus went to the cross? To bear our sins there? And so the cross tells us that sin is real. Alright, our conscience says sin is real. How might our consciences tell us that sin is real? Alright, a properly trained conscience, when you transgress or fall short, how do you feel? Guilty? It eats you up, doesn't it? It's something that tears at you. And so it convicts us of sin, and God, we train our conscience how? How do we go about training our conscience properly? Alright, we have to use the Word of God, don't we? God gives us the training manual, and we are to follow it. Alright? What about Satan? How does Satan tell us that his existence tell us that sin is real? Or show us that sin is real? Alright? Temptations in the world. What does James say about temptation? James chapter 1, 13 through 15. Alright, it's common to all man. Alright, let no man say when he is tempted that he is tempted of God. Why? I'm sorry? Alright, it's born of our own desires. Alright, and this is what I want to talk about for a minute. Don't give Satan too much power, right? Can Satan make me do anything? Can't make me do anything. All right. How many times in the Bible do we read of Satan directly tempting mankind? All right. That's one. Christ. That's two. Garden of Eden. All right. Three times that we read there are probably more that are not recorded for us, but three times that we read of Satan directly tempting mankind. Of those three, how many times was he successful? Once. Okay. Once. Now baseball, he's probably doing alright. He's hitting 333. But Satan, he doesn't have that much power. He could not physically force Eve to eat of that tree, could he? She already had that desire. The Bible tells us, as a matter of fact, when she looked on it and saw that it was good for food, that's when she lusted after it. He simply put the idea there. She had to act on it. And so when someone says the devil made me do it, friends, that's the furthest thing from the truth. The devil can't make me do anything. Okay, we can't give Satan that much power. When we do that, we've given him more power than God has given him. How was Satan able to accomplish what he did against Job? God gave him permission. What does that tell us about Satan's power? Very limited. Very limited. He can't do anything of his own volition, really. Matter of fact, the Bible goes on to teach us that when as Jesus died upon the cross, He rose again the third day. What did that do to Satan? What does God prophesy way back in Genesis chapter 3? Alright, He would bruise the heel of the seed of woman. Satan would. Alright, what would that seed do to him? Bruises what? His head. How do you want to kill a snake? Crush or cut off the head, right? That's what you do with it. That's the idea here. The death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, what did it do to the head of Satan? It crushed it. Satan no longer has the power over death, does he? That was the one thing that he held over us. And now he no longer has that power. He's been crushed. And so we don't need to be giving Satan more power than God has given him. All right, what does history say about sin? What's the flood teach us about sin? Wouldn't the flood say that sin is real? Ma'am? Okay. Sodom and Gomorrah teaches us that sin is real. Babylon, Jerusalem, those places and what happened there show us that sin was indeed real. What about the present condition of society? Listen to this for just a moment. There is serious crime committed in this country every 6.5 seconds. Just this country. That's not worldwide. Just this country. Every 6.5 seconds. The nation's crime clock, as computed by the FBI, also reveals that a burglary is committed every 16 seconds. A larceny of $50 or more is committed every 21 seconds. A car is stolen every 36 seconds. A robbery is committed every 2 minutes. A forcible rape is committed every 14 minutes. An aggravated assault is committed every 2 minutes. And a murder is committed every 36 minutes. Minutes and seconds, not days, not hours. That's just the United States. That doesn't take into account every other country in the world. That's just the United States. What does that tell us about sin? It's real. And it's something that we've got to contend with. But if we have an attitude towards sin that we're just going to pretend that it's not there, we've already lost the battle. We can't have that attitude. Improper attitude number 2 is some folks mock sin. They mock it. So I'm going to read for us Proverbs 14 and verse 9. Proverbs 14 and verse 9. Fools mock sin. Fools. All right. In Proverbs 10 and verse 23, Proverbs writer says, to do evil is like sport to a fool, but a man of understanding has wisdom. Okay, so a fool, God says, of someone that mocks sin, what does he call him? A fool. All right. What is a fool? How would you describe a fool? How would you define fool? Right. Flip Wilson said that a lot too, didn't he? Yeah. Flip Wilson said it. I know Flip Wilson did. Devil made me do it. But the fool mocks him. How would we describe a fool? How would you define the word? Okay, without knowledge. The fool says in his heart there is no God. Okay. Without wisdom. You look at each time that the Bible talks about a fool, and I think there's one thing here that we see in common each time the Bible uses the word fool. I might describe a fool like this. Someone who knows better but goes ahead and does it anyway. Without wisdom. Right? He doesn't apply what he knows. The fool says in his heart, there is no God, okay? Here's all this evidence presented before him, right? And still, what does he say? There's no God. He knows better. The evidence has been presented, and yet he still denies it, okay? With sin, as we just read in the Proverbs, for instance, chapter 10 and verse 23, evil is like a sport unto a fool. Okay, he does it for fun. He knows better. He understands and he knows that it's not right, but he does it anyway. That's the idea of a fool. And he mocks sin. He knows better, but he just He just does it anyway. Okay. Yeah. That's how you could describe a fool. When we make sin a joke, right? That's mocking sin. When we make it something funny or make it something that is fun, it's to mock at it. Friends, I might bring, just for an example, Hollywood mocks sin. You can't watch, listen, you can be watching, you might be watching Disney cartoons, but then a commercial comes on, like the Hardee's or the Carl's Jr. commercials. I've got to change. You can't watch that stuff. That's a commercial, a 30-second spot, and it's filling your mind with sin. Taco Bell has now joined that realm. And so you've got to be careful of this. But when we allow those things into our home, when we allow those things to continue to enter our minds, and we're watching these things, we're joining right with them. We're holding hands with these folks that are putting that stuff out. And that's mocking. That's making a mockery of sin. All right. I don't know. I haven't watched it. But has anybody sat down and watched the mockery of the Bible that is called Noah? Do you know what the director, or it was either the director or the producer, you know what he said about that movie? And he bragged about that movie? He said that it was the least biblical Bible-based movie that Hollywood ever made. Okay, so it's just, you know, they mock it. And when we try to make it into a joke or make it something funny or make it fun, we mock it. But friends, to laugh at, to joke at, or make fun of sin, when we do that, we're laughing ourselves straight into hell. And we have to be careful of having that type of attitude. Look at ancient Rome, for instance. Wouldn't you say that ancient Rome mocked sin? You look at the hippodromes and the Colosseums that they built, the gladiatorial games, that's a mockery of sin. They threw people in there and let them murder one another for entertainment. That's a mockery of sin. What about Babylon? Babylon make a mockery of sin? Absolutely they did. Assyria? You better believe it. And friends, we're seeing it around the world. What happens when, and really, we'll just look at it as a national problem. What happens in history when a nation mocks sin for a prolonged period of time? God takes care of them, doesn't he? God takes care of them. What happened to Babylon? Syria, Persia, Rome? They fell. God takes care of them. All right? Improper attitude number three. To love sin. This is, as a Christian, this ought to be one that is hard for us to fathom, but we look at the world and we see folks embracing it. To embrace sin here. To love it. There are many passages really in the Bible. You look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 15, 1 John 2, 15 to 17. The psalmist writes about the love of sin the world has for sin. And Proverbs 17 and verse 19, Revelation 22 and verse 15. There are all these passages and more concerning the love of sin. Friends, we have to be careful not to fall in love with sin and sinful practices. Men have pleasure in that in which they love. What does the Bible say about Moses? All right, he was humble. But concerning the, he decided to suffer with his people rather than do what? Enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season. Okay? What's the idea there, enjoying the pleasure of sin for a season? What's the idea behind sin in that, in that vocabulary there? Okay. Our physical life is not eternal, right? Okay? And so, Moses could have stayed in the palace, right? He could have stayed in Pharaoh's house. He could have had all the food he wanted to eat. He could have had, no doubt, as a son of Pharaoh, he could have had a wonderful life as far as the physical pleasures. But what do we see in that time in the land of Egypt? You see sin running rampant, don't you? As a matter of fact, how does Pharaoh respond when Moses first comes to him and tells him that God says, let my people go? Who is God that I should obey His voice? What does that show you right off the bat about Egypt and sin? They didn't have a proper understanding of God, the God of heaven, for one, but they have embraced Pharaoh as even now, you can see in that statement that he is even already now looking at himself as what? A God. He set himself up as God's equal by making that statement. And God was going to show him that he was not. But men have pleasure in that which they love. Men, you look at the world today, men who love fishing, hunting, athletic games find pleasure in those things. In the same way, those who love sin find pleasure in unrighteousness. You see it as 2 Thessalonians 2:10 through 12. You look as well at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, Proverbs 21 and verse 17. All these talk about men who love sin. Romans 1 and verse 32. All right, let's look at that one. Romans chapter 1 and verse 32. Look what Paul here writes to the Romans concerning not just the Romans, but the Gentiles and sin. Romans chapter 1 and verse 32. Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but what? Also approve of those who practice them. Okay, they love sin, in other words. And so Paul writes concerning that. Friends, in loving sin, if one loves sin, then he loves the very instrument, he loves the very instrument that killed Jesus. What we said a few moments ago, sin is what put Christ on the cross. Friends, how would we react to a father cherishing, caressing, polishing, and caring for the switchblade with which his son was stabbed to death? We recoil at the thought. And yet, the many that love and cherish sin, the very instrument that slew the Savior, that's what they're doing. Something for us to consider. Number four. Sometimes we minimize sin. We minimize it. I believe someone said that at the beginning of our class. We minimize sin when we don't call it what it is. When we fail to call a spade a spade. Okay? We cannot, absolutely must not minimize sin. Friends, we're being told by those that are liberal-minded that sin sounds too harsh. Sin sounds too condemning. And so we need to offer it a different name. We need some sulfur sounding names, some less offensive nomenclature, if you will, that won't make it sound so condemning. And so folks are speaking of sin as immature, development, as negative goodness or misdirection, a defective temper, a mere mistake. Friends, we need to remember to call sin what God called it. He called it sin. He called it transgression. He called it missing the mark. He called it falling short. Those of that same mindset are calling lust love. They're calling hardcore pornography tagged art. They're calling lying coloring the truth. They're calling dishonesty shrewdness. They're calling car theft joyriding. They're calling cursing and obscenity just simply emphatic speech. They're calling drunkenness alcoholism. They're calling adultery biological maladjustment. They're calling murder a release from previous traumatic experience. Compromising on sin, right? Yeah. We need to stop sugarcoating it, bottom line. Stop sugarcoating sin. Listen to Abraham Lincoln. He was once asked, he rather once asked a group, if you call a sheep's tail a leg, how many legs would he have? They promptly answered five. And Lincoln answered, he said, wrong. Calling it a leg doesn't make it one. How true is that? And whitewashing sin does not change it from what it really is. What did Jesus call the Pharisees? Whited sepulchers. Did it change it from being a grave or a tomb? No. Not at all. What's still inside? Rotting flesh and bones. That's it. It was still a sepulcher. We cannot minimize sin. We minimize sin as well when we make it inconsequential. When we just shrug it off. Brush it to the side. Isn't that what Ahab did? You look at Ahab's life, and what did he do with sin his entire life? It was just inconsequential to him. What did he do when Jezebel killed the owner of the vineyard? He went and took possession. He knew it wasn't his. He knew it didn't belong to him, and yet he minimized it. He went and took possession. Friends, when we minimize sin, God calls that an abomination, Proverbs 17 and verse 15. And yet we continue to hear, it'll all come out in the wash. As if soot could be turned into snow. Someone else says, well, you know, 100 years from now, what I've done will be, it's going to be forgotten. Really? What's going to happen 100 years from now? After we're dead and gone and we find ourselves in torments. Or maybe even tomorrow. If we find ourselves standing at the judgment seat of God. Is it going to be forgotten then? Friends, we can't minimize sin. We minimize sin. Are you listening? We minimize sin when we rationalize it. When we try to justify it. You know, if we twist it and bend it and we jump through enough hoops, we can rationalize anything, can't we? We can make it sound good. But friends, when we do that, we minimize sin. And really, friends, so oftentimes when we talk to someone about sin, it's explained as something that develops from without rather than from within. Sin is said to be antisocial action resulting from improper education. Man is only, in other words, someone says, man is only the product of his rearing. And if that's the case, I'm not responsible for my actions. Who's responsible for it? Mom and Dad. Whatever I do is not my fault. It's their fault. Isn't that what we're seeing in society today? And so we have to be careful of minimizing sin. Let's not rationalize its cause. I'm saying this as a preacher, okay? And when we look at just, you know, sound congregations, you're going to have preaching on sin, okay? But when we look at so many, and we may not even say liberal congregations, but weak, rarely will we find strong preaching on sin. Infrequent preaching on sin, a woeful lack of church discipline, an indifference in soul winning, all of these are evidence of minimizing sin. Friends, if we don't preach on sin, we don't practice church discipline, and we're not out trying to win souls, how do we account for one another? How do we account for sin? How are we held accountable as such? As the Lord's church, we need to be holding one another accountable as such. We minimize sins when we magnify others. Okay? When we make one sin less than something else. For example, we minimize our own sins and then we magnify those, maybe even those same sins. We magnify them in others while the opposite is really often the cause. Well, as a matter of fact, what does Jesus say about that? Then if you got something in your eye, what does Jesus tell me to do? All right, you've got something in your eye. I got to get the beam out of my eye before I can see to get it out of Dennis's eye, right? All right, so get whatever's in your eye out first, right? Don't minimize your sin and magnify theirs. Is the point? Because often it's the other way around. Look, think about we call it oftentimes the prodigal son. What is that parable really about? As Jesus is speaking. Who is it about? Is it about the prodigal or is it about the older son? It's about the elder son, isn't it? All right, the elder son represents who? To whom was he speaking? The Jews, right? They, you know, he said, when you asked me to go to the field, what did they do? I went to the field. When you asked me to do this, I did that. I've never left your side, and now here you've killed the fatted calf for him? What is Jesus saying about the Jews as they viewed the Gentiles coming into the Lord's kingdom? They're saying, we've never left your side, but you're killing the fatted calf for the Gentiles. They were magnifying the sins of the Gentiles and not thinking of of the things that they had done. And so Jesus points that out in that. We need to stop treating sin lightly. All right, number five, and very quickly. Making sure we stay on schedule here. An improper attitude towards sin, we said this a few minutes ago, is just to dismiss it. Isn't this what Felix did in Acts chapter 17? To dismiss sin. As a matter of fact, he just told Paul, go your way, and I'll call you when it's more convenient to me. When I'm ready to stop sinning, I'll give you a call. And so we just dismiss sin. Friends, that's a very foolish attitude. Okay, and understand that we have some that have battled cancer or even currently are, battling cancer. All right, you find out you have cancer and you've got it in the early stages, but you just decide to wait 6 months, a year, or 2 years to try to do anything about it. What's happened by the time you finally go to take treatments or to have it removed? All right. Sometimes it's going to be too far gone for them to be able to do anything at this point. It will have metastasized. It will have gotten into other places in the body. It's going to be too far along to be able to do anything about it. Friends, isn't that what sin is? Couldn't we refer to sin as a cancer? If we allow it to remain, what does it do? What does cancer do if we allow it to remain? It'll kill you. It'll eat your body up. Sin, if allowed to remain, what is it going to do? Romans 6 and verse 23. The wages of sin is what? Death. Sin's going to kill you. But what's the end of that verse say? What's the end of the verse? Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of eternal life is from God. And so, okay, so God has given us a gift personified in Jesus Christ, dying upon the cross. We don't have to die. We can do something about sin, but we cannot dismiss it. So we need to say, just as the publican did in Luke 18 and verse 13, God be merciful to me, a sinner. We have to deal with sin just like he did. We have to meet it head on. Let's get ourselves ready for worship.